This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Ellis Mitchell. I probably can't imagine another guest who's had the wealth of experience that Ron Howard brings to this program. His movie, now coming to DVD and playing theater still, is Cinderella Man. Ron, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
If you can talk a little bit about Cinderella Man and catch the audiences up a little bit about it, because it's an enormously sort of powerful and epic story.
Yeah, well, that's why I wanted to become involved with it, was because it operates on a number of levels. Russell Crowe actually brought the project to my attention after we did A Beautiful Mind. And, you know, on one level, it's about a true story about Jim Braddock and his family, his wife May and his kids, a Depression-era boxer who, right in the middle of the Depression, he was athletically really washed up, injured. You know, he was at best a 50-50 fighter, making, you know, paltry sums in the ring. And they finally stripped him of his license. And right at that point, his family, unfortunately, had reached a point where they were starving. They were on the breadlines. He couldn't find work. He worked at the docks when he could get it. And just sort of extraordinarily made this incredible comeback. And they literally he started winning these bouts. And he was always the underdog. He won four bouts in a row. And he went from fighting from the breadline to fighting for the heavyweight championship of the world in 1 year's time. And he became, of course, a national folk hero, and and reflected the possibility of hope. And in fact, I had heard about Braddock because my dad was a lifelong fight fan. And the first fight that his dad had taken him to listen to, my dad grew up in the Midwest, and they drove from the farm into the pool hall to listen to Jim Braddock fight Max Baer, listen to the Cinderella Man fight Baer for the heavyweight championship. So I sort of knew the lore of Jim Braddock. But the other aspect was that for years, I'd been looking for a way to deal with the Depression in a movie, and in the way that I understood it, more through the stories of my mom and dad.
Because the thing I always sort of thought in seeing the movie is that this must have been a lot like your father's experience, hearing these stories, but also movies you probably grew up seeing, like Grapes of Wrath and that kind of thing, that dealt – a lot of those movies that of the 30s and 40s dealt with the Depression.
Well, they did, and very effectively and powerfully, and I did used to hear about it. And my dad grew up on a farm. My mom grew up in a small town. This is in Oklahoma. My dad was not a Dust Bowl refugee, but they were subsistence farmers and made it through. And then things got better during World War II, as it did for the country economically. But, you know, I used to hear about this sort of struggle to scrape together 5 cents to, you know, to buy a pocket knife. They had food because they were farmers and the farm was working. What struck me was the fear that as a young boy, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, that he recalled, the anxiety that the whole country would blow up, conversations in his dad's kitchen where a lot of farmers would get together, and this was before FDR, and they expected there to be food riots in the town that was like 20 miles away, and they fully expected that at harvest time they might have to defend their crops. And they literally had a kind of an informal militia where they talked about how they'd block one road with some trucks and they'd blow up a bridge and they'd guard each other and help each other to make sure that they could get their harvest in and at least feed themselves. This is the kind of thing that as a kid he was hearing, that he told me that – and his father, I mean, I remember him, very easygoing, you know, guy, liked everybody, easy to laugh, enjoyed people and all that kind of thing. But my dad told me that when a car came up your road, the first thing you felt was alert and alarm. And that's because every once in a while something would get stolen or they'd heard stories about people stealing for food.
I don't know if you read much Steinbeck at all, but there's this sense of that I think the movie in that first third really gets at, this sort of sense of utter hopelessness.
Yeah.
That, you know, not thinking about – it wasn't even day-to-day subsistence, but really hour-to-hour subsistence.
Well, this is what Braddock went through, but and his letters really reflect that, which fortunately I had a chance to read. And I thought, well, okay, look, here's a triumphant story. He prevails. And it's remarkable. But it really – it's one thing to live a kind of a fairy tale, and from the outside you say, look at that, a wonderful fairy tale kind of story. But a very different thing to live inside that fairy tale when you don't know there's a happy ending waiting for you on the other side. And I felt like it was a great opportunity to deal with the price of poverty and hunger in a way that, you know, could reach audiences who might not go see a documentary or read Studs Terkel's book, Hard Times.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. We're talking to Ron Howard about Cinderella Man. It's The Treatment. What movies tend to offer nowadays is a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a movie that for the first third basically says there's no hope.
Right.
And you're really counting on audiences to sort of sit for that though, aren't you?
Well, absolutely. And it was very important to me because, generally the depression gets reflected in movies as either the backdrop for a gangster story and occasionally the Dust Bowl story. But when I was in high school, the first sort of long-form film I did, it was 30 minutes long, moving beyond kind of movies I could shoot in one weekend that were just more jokes or kind of inside jokes, like trying to do kind of my own version of The Wild Bunch or something with a lot of blood and ketchup and stuff flying around, was a report for my social studies class, and they let me make a film instead of a written report, and I did a documentary about the Depression, and I got all the I interviewed 7 or 8 people who had lived through the Depression, and I edited their interviews and weaved it all together with some narration, which I did, and then I went and photographed stills, kind of like Ken Burns does, you know, where you push in on the faces and you pan from one face to the other, and what struck me was something that I've never forgotten, and I recognized in the screenplay for Cinderella Man that there was this possibility to offer this to audiences. The shell-shocked look on the faces of city dwellers. So, you know, the rural families, you know, they look pretty desperate, but I also always had a sense that rural folks kind of know how to suffer. But you'd see these people still – men still in their suit and ties, you know, and you'd see women in their good Sunday hats and they'd be in these bread lines, or the men would be selling apples for a penny a piece or 5 cents a piece, or kids would be digging through garbage. And you'd see these bridges and these skyscrapers that you know, only months before had represented this kind of this new utopia. And you know, and I just always thought that for those people who really had the rug pulled out from under them, who thought they knew what the future held, that the Depression was devastating in ways that our country's, you know, probably never really experienced. But the other little thing, and of course you can't really say this in a movie set in the period, and I don't like to lecture in films anyway, but you know, of course, this idea of working families struggling and starving has not gone away.
And the movie came out at a time where gasoline prices were up, and it really felt in a lot of ways like the Depression all over again.
Well, you know, I think since the internet bubble burst, stock market went down, then 9/11 happened, now we're at war, you know, we're not in a depression, and I don't want to take away from what those people endured because that was really amazing, and 25% of the population was out of work and it was dire. But a lot of people are dealing with a lot of uncertainty right now, and a lot of people are wondering, you know, recognizing how little it would take for them to sort of fall off the face of the earth, so to speak. And it's I did hope that the movie, and I do hope that the film it at least sensitizes people to, you know, what poverty and hunger can actually do to a family, and yes, it's a noble celebration of what this guy was able to do to pull his family out of that. He was an extraordinary man. In fact, I think it's the story of a great man, not a great athlete. But he used what he knew how to do, and he had some luck. But there are a couple of moments that you know, Akiva Goldsman, who came in and did the rewrite on it, and I built into the film that Russell Crowe really understood and really did well, where we basically acknowledge that, hey, Braddock knows he's lucky, that not everybody has the possibility of – even the remotest possibility of fighting for the heavyweight championship of the world and making thousands of dollars in one night and pulling his family out of off the breadline in such a dramatic way. And so it's one of the reasons we kept the Mike storyline, the storyline of the friend, going. I mean, that's the one element of the story that is a real amalgamation of, you know, what we could glean about people who were around Braddock at the time. But it's that character and his storyline is, you know, that's fiction. And it was important to have another character who was continuing to spiral at the same time that Braddock was climbing out of his pit, because we just, you know, I knew that Braddock was not – he was seeing that kind of devastation around him all the time. So we synthesized it into a single story so that the audience could remember that just because a guy wins a couple of fights doesn't mean that the problem's solved, certainly not for the nation and not even in the back of his mind. You know, what if he were to lose? Would he be back on that breadline?
It's the treatment, I guess, is Ron Howard. We're talking about Cinderella Man. I guess as I was watching it, for some reason, I was reminded of I'm a Fool.
Well, that's amazing that you even saw I'm a Fool. that was a short film directed by Noel Black. It was a Sherwood Anderson short story that I acted in. I was probably 21 years old, so we're talking 30 years ago. But it was a great little series of public television American short stories.
But I thought of that as I was watching this, and I wonder if that occurred to you too. I mean, because that's sort of treating – I mean, it's a different kind of story, but it's also really kind of about a sense of – it's a much more personal story about loss, but it's definitely about feeling that you kind of lost your future there.
Well, look, as fortunate as my life has been, as blessed as I've been, we all see and feel and understand that kind of insecurity on all kinds of levels and the impact of loss. And so, no, I can't say that I went back and really, you know, viewed I'm a Fool again or thought too much about it. I sort of understand and relate to the kind of struggle, particularly a family faces, more so than a single individual, because I've always been part of a family and got married young, started my family young as a father and a husband. But you know, my family when we were growing up was close knit. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why families always play an important part in my films. It's because it's like something that I can, with confidence, thematically kind of hang my hat on, and I can understand and express the impact of a circumstance on a family.
And that's also something that's kind of disappeared a lot from movies. I mean, but we were talking before we got started, your movies often are like certainly de facto families or ensemble mm-hmm. pieces anyway.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in process and how people – I'm interested in teams. I loved being on teams. The kinds of sports I was attracted to were team sports. One of the things that I did as a teenager was not only play team sports, but I also coached. I enjoyed that. My partner, Brian Grazer, he's a solo guy. I'm interested in that coordinated endeavor. So whether it's work and, as you said, the de facto family, the people who decide, you know, we got an objective that we got to try to meet, or family, I'm just drawn to it. I relate to it, understand it, and I'm fascinated by it because, you know, all kinds of crazy things happen, the good and the bad. There's a lot of pain in those associations, and yet, it's at least an aspect of society is built on the back of those kinds of units.
We'll take a break. My guest is Ron Howard. We're talking about a lot of things. Cinderella Man, too. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm torturing Ron Howard. You're talking about Cinderella Man. I'm Elvis Mitchell's The Treatment. I hate to throw a thematic question at you, but now you've provoked me. You've thrown down a gauntlet. I've got to do it. So many of your movies as a director, in addition to the familial aspect, are about dealing with fear. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily overcoming fear, mm-hmm. but dealing with fear.
Right.
I mean, we can even go back to Eat My Dust. Yeah. It's all about
I didn't direct that one. I had to act and eat my dust in order to get to direct Grand Theft Auto.
But those movies are definitely about that.
Yeah.
Just talking about I'm a Fool, there's a kind of a free-floating dread or fear that's in all of these movies.
Yeah. Sadly, another thing that I relate to is that kind of anxiety, you know, the possibility that it could be taken away. How do you feel if it is taken away? It makes for great conflict and drama.
Sure.
And I think that it's the kind of – I think characters being tested, you know, just makes for good cinema, good drama. I'm always interested in stories, not exclusively, but that they're really sort of two kinds of narratives. Because basically what's a narrative? I mean, you're taking elements of a life or a group of lives in a situation and you're shaping it into a story. It's going to have a resolution. When it resolves, that's going to underscore a perspective or a theme, right? So you can either – they're either tragedies or social critiques, cautionary tales that sort of remind us that horrible things can happen.
And they're for the grace of God to go on.
Or not. You know, in the case of tragedy, not. You know, you suffer the consequences. The character suffers the consequences and there's a great deal of pain and suffering that goes along with that. Then there's another kind that's really a celebration. And it's usually a kind of an acknowledgement that despite the struggle, the fear, the anxiety of life, the obstacles that are thrown up, you know, at us, that thing that so human, which is to try to achieve these moments of joy or peace or self-actualization, that when the story resolves on that note, it's a celebration. It's saying despite all the struggle, you know, there is this possibility. There is a reason to hope. And ultimately, most stories fall into two categories and the best stories have a measure of both, right?
Sure. Obviously, that's what you were trying to do with Cinderella Man too, is include that social critique in the tragedy. But for me, in these movies, I think that you can attach Night Shift to this to some extent, and is that there's a character who has a level of competence in what he does
right. That
suddenly has that stripped away from him.
Right.
I'm not saying it's categorical, but certainly a prevalent thing in your work.
I think those kind of realistic nightmares, so it's not about monsters, but it's about the other shoe dropping. Look, again, I've led an unbelievably blessed life, but I've occasionally used that very phrase. I've said, you know, well, things are going great, but, you know, I wonder if that other shoe is going to drop and what will it be like when it does? And so I think that's an element that I also relate to whatever the tone, whatever the genre, it's something that I can offer the story as a director. And I think it's relatable because I think a lot of people feel that when you talk.
I think so too, but it's a very American thing the way you treat that, because what is the measure of a man in America? Doing his job, mm-hmm. having an expertise in the job. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you say go from Night Shift to Cinderella Man about a guy who knows what he does, being as a coroner or a boxer,
right.
and suddenly he can't do this anymore.
Right.
Or this thing that he knows.
Michael Keaton in the paper. Suddenly they're not going to let you do the headline you believe in.
You know, Mel Gibson in Ransom.
Yeah.
It's this thing, or the fact is what he does in his life, or Apollo 13,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
there's something that comes in that he couldn't possibly have expected. I mean, right. to me, it's sort of like the concrete and then the nightmare coming into it, the thing mm-hmm. that you could – it's almost the worst thing that could happen, worse than the other shoe dropping. It's the thing that you could never have expected.
Well, Elvis, I've never connected all these dots in my stuff, but I think you're on to something. And again, I'm always talking about the other shoe dropping or the rug getting pulled out from under.
Sure.
And I guess I think that is a modern fear. Maybe it's always – maybe throughout history, you know, people have worried that the big storm was going to come. And so let's pray to the sun god so that the sun shines. Or, you know, maybe, I've always said that one of the things that stymied the space program is that we're no longer afraid of Russia getting to the moon first or the repercussions of someone else exploring space before we do. And so, you know, I, unfortunately, I think we are fueled by it. And look, I think that that also creates suspense. I think all films, to be interesting and, you know, need to be suspenseful. And again, whatever the tone, whether it's Wedding Crashers or whether it's, I haven't seen Brokeback Mountain yet, but I know that, you know, just from what I've read about it, that's going to be very suspenseful when I see it. Or what I hope Cinderella Man is suspenseful in that way. I thought Good Night and Good Luck was incredibly suspenseful. There aren't guns going off and car chases, but you know it's good drama because you sort of wonder what's going to happen next, and that's what I try to look for in all the stories as well.
Yeah, but I'm fascinated by this because you talked about being a real sort of having a real interest in tame stuff, and your movies are very much about tames often, but. That sort of sense of not being able to do what it is the way you define yourself. I wonder if that's kind of a fear for you. I mean, because these are movies very much about people who can't do that thing that they figure they can wake up every morning and be able to do this.
And they're going to let themselves down and the team.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it exactly. But that sort of loss of confidence that comes from not being able to conduct yourself in that way you define yourself as a person is a really interesting sort of psychological underpinning for a story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so too, and again creates great conflict. And my dad, Rance Howard, who's still working great. It's a great thing about being a character actor.
Your dad, he's in Chinatown, by the way.
Yeah, he was in Chinatown. He works all the time. 77 years old, and he's working as much now as he ever did. But also, has written over the years, directed, never filmed a lot of theater and that kind of thing. And as a kid, I used to grow up, I realize now. That, when I was 5, he was 30 and he was still only 12 years off the farm. And he was learning a lot about this medium. And he was taking writing classes. There's a famous guy named Leos Agri who wrote a terrific book, The Art of Dramatic Writing. And my dad, took a class from Leos Agri and used to talk to me a lot about that. And, one of the basic – there are a couple of principles of Leos Agri that I've tried to apply – and one of them is, where is the crisis in the story? Early on, what happens? And, what is the threat? And, how does that throw a couple of characters into conflict or a character into a conflict against nature or, so the protagonist versus antagonist? And then the other thing is, what is the unbreakable bond? What holds these characters in conflict? It really, in addition to, we were talking earlier about sort of my childhood growing up at the Andy Griffith Show and seeing this process of creative problem solving, as joyous as the experience was and as much laughter as there was always this objective, how do we make the show great? How do we do this thing we do to the very best of our ability? And but I also was blessed because my dad was around constantly learning and from a very early age, happy to talk about it. So I got a pretty good education from him as he was learning himself.
I guess we're talking about Cinderella Man with Ron Howard is the treatment. I guess just my thinking about this and watching the films and getting ready for this to try to think about this, it's just sort of wondering for me – if your moments are sort of crisis or questioning yourself, this kind of relates to the fear of the artist is essentially what this is. You've been playing this out in so many ways because these guys who are the protagonists of your stories, these people who do this, are in their way kind of, exemplars of their craft at some point or another. Mm-hmm. A professional boxer, people who are able to sort of support themselves doing what they love.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder for you if that's kind of a fear, that sort of that classic fear of the artist. I'm not going to able to do this.
Man, I need to pay you some money. This is a shrink session. Especially with this medium. My wife published her first novel this year, In the Face of Jen. She loves what she does. She's been working on that novel for 9 years. Now she's got two more books that she's getting ready to work on. But for her, she not only threw out drafts of that book, she threw out other books that she just didn't think were good enough. But she just gets to start over with a blank piece of paper. She doesn't really need anyone else to practice her art. I do. However, as much as I like to collaborate and I love the thrill of, engaging with a handful of really talented artists and sort of leading them on this creative expedition, this journey that each movie always proves to be. You know, I also like being the leader, and I like the buck stopping with me. But I do need their belief. I need a system. And I do shudder to imagine what it would be like the day that they would say, not interested in working with you anymore. So it is the artist's fear. And I feel it, you know, palpably. It's not rational.
Because you had a father who, as you were saying, was constantly curious,
right,
always asking himself questions about what he did, talking with that about you,
yeah,
and sort of exploring these possibilities. So it's fascinating to me that given this sort of enormous amount of sort of curiosity and insecurity that must have been in your household about the arts, that this thing manifests itself in your work.
It is kind of interesting, but, you know, from 1960 to 1980, I was on three different TV series as an actor. Andy Griffith Show, Smith Family with Henry Fonda, and The Happy Days. And I was on a series for like 17 and a half out of those 20 years. That's a particular kind of way of life. It's much more like going to the office, and particularly when you're an actor. And so there's a part of me that had a sort of a calling. And I don't think I realized it, but it was, you know, it was sort of a call to adventure. It was kind of leaving the safety of an environment that was incredibly rewarding, that I understood quite well, but that didn't offer the same kind of singular challenge that every one of these films does. And it really doesn't matter, again, what the tone is, what the budget is. It's a high wire act. And each is its own kind of minefield, and eventually you're going to be judged. And that period of judgment is going to be public. And it's going to, it's going to impact not only you, but not only the people who invested in the film, perhaps, but also the people who chose to work with you, and say yes, you know, I you lead me, you know, I feel that responsibility. It's a thrill. I want to do it until I can't do it anymore, but it's definitely a particular kind of commitment, and look, it's yielded. Already, I'm 51 years old, an unbelievably rich range of experiences that I can't imagine, given my personality, I ever would have experienced any other way. And I'm incredibly grateful for it. And I just love the medium. And I love the work. It's just endlessly fascinating.
One at a time, Ron. Thanks so much for stopping by to do this.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
My guest is Ron Howard. The movie, of course, they're talking about is Cinderella Man, which is on DVD now. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson edits the program. Mary Holdridge is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is not a shrink session. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.